Blog Talk Radio. Joining us on Challenging the Rhetoric. Any other show by this name is a duplication or fabrication. Our mission statement is news by women for women. You can find us on challengingtherhetoric.com, the same name on Facebook for our Facebook page, and on Twitter at Rhetoric versus Facts. That's the word rhetoric, then VS Facts. Our other hashtags are Challenging the Rhetoric and CTR. Tonight is Thursday, August 27th. We're doing part two of an interview with Dadi Sherry, which originally aired on Wise Women Media Radio on August 5th. We were in the middle of a conversation with Miss Sherry, speaking to her about her new book, We Have Dared to Be Free, Haiti's Struggle Against Occupation. This book took 5 years to write, is published by News Junkie Post Press, and is about the humanitarian occupation that's currently taking place in Haiti. Part one is already archived. Part three will be aired tomorrow night. Actually, we will not be airing it. It will be archived for you to listen to. So if you look us up on Challenging the Rhetoric or Rhetoric versus Facts, you'll see the link there. So you can click in and just hit the arrow to hear episode part three. So, without further ado, we will go ahead and play the interview, the second part. And where we left off was we were having a conversation with Ms. Sherry about USAID, about the former President Clinton, and about the NGOs, which have really created the humanitarian occupation that is taking place on the island, on the portion of the island that is Haiti. Currently. So without any further ado, here goes.
That is not good at all.
I'm noticing as I went to Twitter just to try to get some recent news about Haiti, and I've noticed, of course, that Regine Chassan is there from Arcade Fire, who I mentioned earlier. She lives in Montreal now, but of course she has family that were from Haiti. So she's definitely, I know the band Arcade Fire goes there often and gives money to the country, to their charities of choice. But the other person that was on the same panel today was Chelsea Clinton.
Uh-huh.
So Chelsea Clinton is, I mean, I'm looking at a tweet she did about 4 hours ago. So she's actually there working, I guess, on the behalf of her father, and doing the work down there for the NGOs.
Yes, it's sort of humanitarian imperialism. They're going to help you whether you like it or not. Now, if Haitians really had a choice, would they really choose to have a bunch of foreigners come to the country to do what they like? I don't think so.
No.
And I think that's the bottom line. You know, these people are not wanted, but they have basically taken all the job in health, all the, you know, you to get work in Haiti now. You essentially have to work for an NGO.
Right.
You see? And the government, and what they've done, you know, like hospitals have fallen apart, all sorts of structures have fallen apart. They've been replaced by NGOs. Let me, for example, give you, I discussed this in my book, and it's We Have Dared to Be Free, and it's the first book being published by Chucky Post Press. I discussed this. You have this very, very, very large number of NGOs in Haiti. Right now, it's like, and I don't mean one NGO person. It's like one NGO per 1,000 Haitians. Wow. At the peak, it was one NGO per 500 Haitians. Wow. Right after the earthquake. And you look around, and it gets worse all the time. Things are getting worse. As their numbers are increasing, things are getting worse. It is not, you know, ultimately, if the country, if Haitians are going to have a choice, if Haitians are going to have a democratic government, then the NGOs are going to have to abide by rules. They're going to have to give the help, whatever help they give, within the constraints that are imposed on them by the people that they are helping. They cannot just come and do whatever they like. One example was there were some NGOs. They decided to set up a cholera clinic right next to a school in a town called Senat. And the people in the town were in an uproar, nearly throwing rocks at them, and wouldn't have it. There were huge protests. So what did the NGOs do? It was actually NSF, actually. They called MINUSTA, the UN forces, to make sure that the protests were put down. And then they said, we're going to explain it all to you. You really don't understand. There is really no risk to any of the stuff we're doing. You see, this kind of stuff shouldn't happen. Haitians should be able to say, no, we don't want this help. We do not want your cholera clinic here. And that should be that.
It's like the people, instead of the people having people rule, they have no voice in their government at all.
Yes, exactly. And the NGOs, you know, however well-meaning they may appear, I think really at the base of it, they are really imperialists. They believe that it's okay to impose their will on these ignorant natives, ultimately. That is really what they're doing. And
right.
I think that is really their thinking. There's really no respect there.
Let's talk about the money. Now, there was a lot of money that was collected after the earthquake from people all over the world, but so much from the United States. Do you have any idea on what that figure would have been?
It was billions. I think I want to say about $9 billion, but it might be even bigger than that. I think I've seen figures anywhere between $9 and $13 billion.
So it would have been money when they were doing Red Cross commercials and everything, or people were in their churches. They were making a deal to, you know, give $25, give $5 if that's all you've got, give 50 or more. And this from all the well-meaning people that thought that their money was going to go to help the Haitian people.
Can you tell me what's
been done with that money?
Oh, it was just tremendous goodwill after the earthquake. This is goodwill that's been earned by Haitians because of the way they conduct themselves in the United States. People who have had contact with Haitians, say Haitians who work in hospitals, who are nurses, who take care of their parents in nursing homes, and so on. Everybody wanted to help. You know, it turned out, I think the figure is that one out of two American adults actually donated for Haiti.
Wow.
It is completely extraordinary. It is a stunning amount of money.
Right.
Okay. And instead of helping him, he just attracted this incredible predatory element to the country. You know, and the idea was that well, the government is corrupt, and we're going to come in, and we're going to take care of things because we're not corrupt. But actually, not so sure of that. It's true that actually there was plenty of corruption in the government. But if you looked at local government, for example, local government are people who are very well known in their towns or extremely respected. And since the earthquake, this new federal government has actually done away with the local government. They got rid of all the mayors, for example. They got rid of all the local judiciary. But now, this brings us back to Clinton.
Right.
Almost immediately after the earthquake. The earthquake happened January 12, 2010. Okay? By mid-April, Clinton had the Haitian parliament voting on a state of emergency, an 18-month state of emergency.
Wow.
That would allow an organization that was formed by Clinton called the IHRC, the Interim Haiti Reconstruction Committee, or Recovery Committee, okay? It would give them 18 months of carte blanche, 18 months in which they could do anything they wanted without risk of liability to supposedly reconstruct the country.
Right. Okay?
All right. And they were going to manage all these. They got in and they were going to get more aid funds and they were going to manage all the aid funds and reconstruct Haiti. And basically what it became, and this really, I think, gives some insight into what some people in, developed countries would love to have as the ideal government. What Clinton set up is, with this organization, it was top heavy. You would have like 14 donors, 14 major donors, representatives of 14 major donors, which would be him for the United States, the European Union, France, Canada, Brazil, Venezuela, IDB, United Nations, World Bank, CARICOM, OAS, and one for the NGOs, one for the diaspora, and one for everybody else. Okay, so this would make like 14 in all, and then there were all sorts of other donors, but that was not even public. But it was a strictly, pay-to-play affair where they had to put up $100 million or forgive $200 million of debt, and in addition have soldiers, contribute soldiers for the occupation. Okay, so that's the group. And then Haiti would also be represented, but what would represent Haiti is it would be like a prime minister that would be basically handpicked by the international community, and then a member of parliament of their choice, a senator of their choice, something to represent the unions, somebody to represent the business community, and the judiciary and local. But all of these people, they would present basically Clinton's group with a list of names, and they got to pick who they wanted. And that's what was supposed to run Haiti for 18 months.
So there was no elections with this. This was just a selection of people. And the people themselves had no input. So this was almost like an election without the people. It was definitely selection.
In fact, people called it a coup.
Yeah.
They called it a coup d'etat. That's what
it was. Because it was a monetary coup that didn't get bloody. It might have got bloody on the street, but it wasn't. Nobody was killing each other at the top.
And all within 3 months of the earthquake. So Haiti was basically on its back. People were in shock. And all this was happening. And in the parliament itself, they had members who had died, and they were trying to fight this.
Right.
And when they didn't succeed at fighting it, because, well, there are definitely allegations that people had been bribed to make sure there was a forum and that it was voted on, they just took to the street. And there were protests. There were massive protests that went on for months. You know, and you don't hear any about any of this in the United States. But for all of this, there's always been resistance from Haitians.
Yeah, I was actually watching YouTube, so I saw a lot of it, and I was looking at French news and, you know, foreign news reports, because that, it's just so bizarre that we have this close proximity to Haiti, but we get none of its news, and we have to go to foreign, we have to go to Europe or other places to their news outlets to get information.
That is quite true. I really, my experience really just following what's going on in Haiti very closely is that what people call news in the United States are really campaigns. There are campaigns to get a specific reaction, to get a specific action. They're not really
right. And I call it infotainment.
Yes, it is.
Seems to be more infotainment, and, you know, if I put on a news program and they tell me, you know, what style of shoes are people going to be wearing in the fall, well, to me, that's not news.
And what you're talking about the news, and then there's something underneath that is describing what, you know, what Rihanna happens to be doing lately.
Now, let's. We talked a little bit about these NGOs, and pretty much this is just like lawless.
It is lawless.
What is happening with the elections? Because it seems like they're selecting all these people. So who ends up being president of Haiti? And what do you think of the last leaders that have been in Haiti since the earthquake?
Oh, well, the leaders have been in, well, after the earthquake, well, after that whole Clinton thing, there were huge protests. And then to distract people from the protests, more or less, they decided to have elections immediately, you know. And the elections happened between the earthquake and the start of the cholera epidemic. Soon after the start of the cholera epidemic. The cholera epidemic was first discovered on October 21, 2010, and then there were elections in November.
it's kind of like you're sick, and you roll over, and you get out of bed, and you struggle around for a day, and you end up getting, you know, even a worse flu, and end up getting thrown back in bed. It's pretty much the same situation. You're rolling up.
So there were elections, and those elections, those elections were just, they were completely ridiculous. You know, the biggest party, Lavalas, Fanny Lavalas, could not participate. So this is a party that commanded about 80% of the electorate, so it couldn't even participate in the elections. And so In the end, more than 80% of people boycotted it. They wound up with like less than 20%, or maybe about 20% people voting. We should have voted, you know, from the people who should have voted. And after the first round, they didn't get the right people, and so one person was thrown out and another one was thrown in.
Right,
and he wound up becoming president.
Right,
But quite apart from the presidential, and the presidential choices were basically the same. They were both people who were going to continue to allow the state of emergency, who were going to continue to accept the UN presence, who were basically going to do as the international community wanted them to do. They were supposed to be good Vichy presidents. Okay.
So they were just figureheads, basically. Buddy-buddy with the NGOs and the American government and carrying out the same status quo. Tell me a little bit about
the cholera epidemic, because that seems to have been a very serious thing. But as usual, we didn't hear about that very much here. I knew some people that were going down that were doing relief work that were medical, and that is how I knew about it. But can you, without revealing too much that's in the book, what happened there? Because that was blamed on UN people.
Oh, yeah. Well, the cholera epidemic, what happened there is basically in summer 2010, about, I think it was 1,280 Nepalese soldiers, the biggest Asian contingent of UN troops, were sent back to Nepal to train. They were they went to Kathmandu to train, and they got there in the middle of a cholera epidemic. And not only that, but after they finished the training, they got some cursory examinations, and then they were given about 10 days home leave.
Okay.
And then after the 10-day home leave, they were flown back into Haiti. Okay. And they were put in their they were put in like three camps in this area around a city called Mirbalet. Okay. And one of the camps was basically there was a septic tank that was just in absolutely awful in an awful state and was spilling into a stream that was joining a river, that river was feeding a lot of the rice paddies and a lot of the rice fields where a lot of workers were working. And when people go to work in the rice fields, they don't carry huge amounts of stuff with them, you know, and then they just drank the water from there, you know, when they get thirsty. And so they were like the first people hit. It was absolutely devastating for these people.
How many people died from that epidemic?
8,800. More than 8,800 so far. At the last count, it was 8,800.
Wow.
It's massive. It is a massive, massive number of people.
How many people actually got cholera and did not die?
Oh, it's many hundreds of thousands. I think it's probably getting close to, 500,000 at this point.
Yeah, because I saw a number some time ago that said 300,000. So I would say, 500,000 seems realistic. So that's half a million people had cholera, and only about 9,000 died. That's like a miracle that more did not die.
Actually, you know, nobody should die of cholera, and that is something that really that I find very upsetting. If you look at the Cuban workers in Haiti, for example, their mortality rate is way lower than anybody else's. The thing about cholera is you lose a lot of fluids, you lose a lot of salt. And what you need when you are very, very sick is rehydration.
Right.
Okay? Only reason for you to die of cholera is if you swallow a massive amount of the bacteria and it makes you so sick that somebody cannot get into a hospital fast enough for you to get rehydrated, or something like that.
Or if you continue going back to that same water source that's infected and you don't know that it's infected, of course you're going to, put yourself in a worse situation. So.
Yeah, really people should not die of cholera.
No.
It should be. It's not really a fatal disease. And so I consider the 8,800 deaths to be deaths from neglect. I don't think there were 8,800 cases where people were so incredibly sick that they couldn't be taken to a hospital fast enough to save their lives.
Right. And with all the craziness at the time and, And the fact that there were NGOs all over the place and supposed to have been enough health workers for all the people on the island, there was supposed to be, and the fact that these 8,800 didn't get taken care of
We are going to end it right there for tonight. Thank you for listening in. Make sure you give us a like and a follow on Facebook and Twitter. You can see more about us, our other shows, stories, articles at challengingtherhetoric.com. And if you can give a little to help keep us on the air, the GoFundMe link is at our website. If you would like to join us as a contributor, make sure you leave a message there on the site. Part 3 will be aired tomorrow. I will link it up on the website, on our Facebook, and on Twitter. This will be the final part of this interview, so it'll be available tomorrow. And I want to thank all of you for listening and supporting Challenging the Rhetoric. Make sure you also check us out on wisewomenmedia.com. So to take us out, we're going to play a little bit more of that beautiful song. It's a traditional Haitian song called Yellow Bird, and it's being performed by Riva Presso. And have a great night. Thank you to everybody out there that's listening and sharing the information about our program. Thank you.